Hi, my name is Matt vs. Japan, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production focused on the why of business, media, and marketing. It's made by my team at Neural, a digital agency for challenger brands and talent. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's N-E-U-R-A-L-L-E.com. My guest this week, Matt, the creator behind Matt vs. Japan and co-founder of Refold. Thanks for joining over the way in Portland. We were slightly delayed today by an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
First question I had on my mind, is Duolingo the enemy?
Yeah, pretty much. I would say so. My enemy, at least. It all depends on who you're talking to, of course.
Yeah. That's we'll get into that later on. But that was something I picked up in a lot of the interviews, is we shouldn't like Duolingo, so to speak. Which is quite
funny. I mean, well, you got to give Duolingo some credit for just making language learning a popular, accessible thing. Like the other day, I was at the bookstore and the guy who was, you know, checking me out was talking to the other guy next to him about how he's using Duolingo to learn Russian. And so if people who otherwise wouldn't be learning a language or at least trying to learn a language because of Duolingo, then you got to give them some credit as being kind of a gateway drug. But if you're actually trying to learn a language, they're not going to get you very far.
That's actually, you know, that is a good point. The gateway drug, that's the real, it's the vanguard, so to speak. But yeah, I agree. I remember when Duolingo came out, it was one of the first times we were going to Japan. I was like, this is going to be the way for me to learn language again or get excited about it, having done it in high school. And no, it doesn't stick at all. It's very, very basic.
Yeah.
Now, you grew up in Portland. You're still based there. What's sort of your earliest memory of your childhood?
I mean, I don't remember my childhood that well. I moved to Portland when I was one.
Okay.
And probably some of my earliest memories probably just preschool. I have some like really vague snapshot memories of, you know, what the school looked like and stuff like that.
That's it? Just high school, primary school, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's also hard because one thing I'm actually really grateful to my dad for is that he took a lot of home video. So there's a lot of videos of like me and my brothers playing and doing stuff as a kid. And he also, of course, would record the soccer games and stuff, but he'd also just record times when we weren't doing anything, right? We were just sitting around and hanging out and playing. And those are the most interesting ones to watch. Like going back and watching your soccer game as a first grader is the most boring thing in the world, of course. But to just see like, what was it like, you know, in 1999 or whatever, when I was just playing around with my brother or whatever. So since I've seen some of those videos so much and other pictures, there's certain things I can't tell if it's a memory or a memory of a video, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, a memory of a memory. But that's all memories are, aren't they? They're like this consistent memory of a memory and it keeps going and you distort it. Like I remember having memories and my dad going to me like, no, that's not how it happened.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite funny how it becomes like that.
Yeah, I mean, they say that basically every time you remember a memory, every time you recall a memory, it's almost like you're opening up a file and you're tampering a little bit and then you save it. And then you feel like every time it's the same file, but every time you open it, you might be, you know, shifting it a little bit in one direction or another.
That's 100% correct. You and your brothers growing up, were you typically playing outside? Like, were you the types that you'd build ramps and stuff and you'd ride your bikes on the street? Or would you be like inside playing card games or Dungeons and Dragons or something like that or Nintendo? What was the vibe?
I mean, probably more indoor than outdoor. Like in elementary school, my favorite things were Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh! And Beyblade, this other toy.
Yeah.
Probably what ended up pushing me to be really interested in Japan later on. Of course, as a kid, I didn't know those things came from Japan. But yeah, I would be really into like Yu-Gi-Oh! I would love the anime, the TV show, the card game. I would try to dress up like the characters. And then I'd force my brothers to be the other sidekick characters. You know, we'd like mess around, play cosplay and stuff like that.
Beyblades. I remember Beyblades were big here in Australia.
Really, oh yeah, they really were big.
They still sell them, actually. I don't know.
Yeah,
if you know
I think they're technically, yeah, the franchise is still going on. They think they're still making new anime series of it.
Yeah, it's like a Hasbro thing, I think. Yeah, I remember these vividly in the playground. And you'd have those like the rip cords,
oh, yeah,
type thing. I'm just looking at it. Some of these now, the designs are like really intricate now.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, they're like metal and stuff like now. But back in the ones I had, they were mostly plastic.
Plastic,
like
yeah.
One little metal disc in the middle.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that was cool about Beyblade is it was the closest to the anime. Like, if you watch Pokemon, for example, or like Dragon Ball Z, it's like you're not getting anywhere close to that in real life. Yu-Gi-Oh, you're getting a little closer because they're playing a card game. But even so, the card games, they have these holograms that make it look way cooler than it is. But in Beyblades, they're literally just, you know, have the spinning tops. They're battling the spinning tops.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
And of course, crazy stuff happens still, but it's like the closest that you can get to being like, I'm doing the same thing as the guy in the anime. Yeah.
That's cool. I never thought about it like that. What did you think you were going to be as a kid growing up? But even in high school, what did you think you were going to do for work one day?
I mean, as a kid, I don't think I spent a lot of time thinking about that. I mean, actually, maybe I take that back. When I was in middle school, I got really into skateboarding. So I think there was probably a period when I was like, I'm going to be a pro skater. Although it didn't take me too long to realize that that wasn't a very realistic aspiration.
Yeah.
And then in high school, I got really into Japanese. So I think after that, I knew that I wanted to do something related to Japan. And I had a kind of vague vision of myself, like being in Japan and being really fluent in Japanese. But I didn't have a really clear idea of what the particular profession would be, just that it would be something that involved being really fluent in Japanese.
Yeah, right. And did your family, like my family's sort of on my dad's side, they're like fourth generation printers. So print and communication was like always a big thing. Did your family ever have like a strong line of work that they were very focused on? Were they small business owners? What did your parents do?
Yeah, I mean, my dad, he's pretty much always worked at Intel for as long as I can remember. Okay. And he kind of has like a management position. And so honestly, I never even really knew what my dad did as a kid. Like if you would have asked me, I would have told you he worked at Intel. But if you would have like really asked me, like, what is he actually doing all day? I would be like, I have no idea, to be honest. But
you're right.
Actually, there was a period when I was in elementary school where he quit his job at Intel and he opened up an ice cream shop and did that for a couple of years. And it didn't go that well. He ended up going back to Intel in the long term. But that was a pretty cool little spurt, because in elementary school, you know, if your dad owns an ice cream shop, you can go in there and get stuff for free. It's a pretty cool gig.
Wow. What made it, like, why do you think he went? Did you ever ask him why ice cream?
I mean, I probably have at some point. I mean, I kind of know the story of like what led to that whole thing. I mean, I think it was probably midlife crisis type of thing. I mean, I don't know. I probably should go into the details because I don't know if he wants me talking about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, something in that area.
Something in probably. That realm. Okay, yeah. So your fluency journey, it's really interesting. There's a lot of different interviews you've done over the years. So I'm trying to condense a lot of that info so people can get up to speed. But in a nutshell, you said multiple times you were studying Japanese through high school, local college to accelerate your learning, essentially. You started watching anime, or at least it sounds like from a very early age, Pokemon, Dragon Ball Z, all that sort of stuff was like, mm-hmm. you're clearly the same age as me. That was like every morning before primary school, that was on,
mm-hmm.
like that was on TV. And I think you mentioned in a previous interview, it was like the sound of the language that actually drew you in, which I found quite interesting. So it's 2011, you Google how to learn Japanese and you start this AJAT course, which is all Japanese all the time, written by this guy, Katsumoto. And essentially it's this guy trying to create an effective or cost-effective way for people to learn. And it is principally an immersive style of learning. Which is a common or a newer approach, I guess, in the language space. So basically that sort of approach means you spend like 24 hours a day where you can do as much as possible around that language. I think I had some really interesting things here, like listening to Japanese while sleeping or even eating cake with chopsticks, which I found mm-hmm. quite funny. But the whole idea is you cram it through your brain as much of that culture as possible to pick it up. So you go to Japan, you're there for a little while. I know that in a previous interview, you started to become a little bit depressed. So you come back to Portland or home, and then you go back realizing how much you love that culture, so to speak. And I think that was about 2 years after. And yeah, it's very interesting to see how you've developed in hindsight, looking at that period of time of your life and how you've developed this immersive approach. And I guess I was intrigued looking back on that period in particular. Why do you think like an immersive approach attracted you the most? And in hindsight, when you look at the others, do you ever wish that there was another approach that you had been drawn into at all? Or do you think this is the best for you and your personality?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what really drew me in when talking about AJAT is it wasn't necessarily that it was an immersive approach that drew me in. It was that this guy was claiming that he got really good really quickly. So it was the results that drew me in. And he also kind of sold me on this whole worldview of like everything that you know about language learning is totally wrong. All the mainstream stuff is totally backwards. It totally sucks. Japanese actually isn't that hard. You just got to approach it the right way. If you approach it the right way, you can get really good really fast. And it's not magic. It's you learn the way that you learned your first language, right? You got good at that one. Why don't you try applying the same kind of method or the same techniques? And so that whole kind of view of, mostly the results, right? It's kind of like proofs in the pudding. And I think I also liked the idea of like, oh, everyone's wrong and I found the secret, magic method that will let me get ahead, you know? So
that sort of silver bullet, but you're often looking for like the thing that makes it just that bit easier.
Yeah. I mean, we're all looking for the magic secret or the shortcut, right? In this case, it wasn't really a shortcut because we're talking about dedicating your entire life to this. But in a way, it was a shortcut because he's claimed that he reached fluency in 18 months. And a lot of people spend years and years trying to get fluent. They never get there. So I thought, hey, if I give my entire life to this for 18 months and I get the results, that is a shortcut. That is a really good deal.
Why do you think... Like I'd break immersion out next to like two other styles, which is like what I imagine is structural. So like the stuff you learn at high school where they give you a book and it's like, okay, you've got to learn this grammar, these words, these things. And then we just assume that your brain will start putting it all together and understanding sentences, mm-hmm. which in my experience never works. It never works well enough. So there's one component. And then there's the Tim Ferriss of the world, like people who think they're linguistic hackers and they're like, you've just got to learn the 1,000 most common words and then you're sweet and you know everything and you can just communicate that way. Why do you think like immersion is more, in your opinion at least, why do you think it's more beneficial than those two approaches?
Yeah. Well, it's the only approach that's actually going to get you to fluency. Okay. And I'm talking about real fluency where you could sit down and have a meaningful, deep conversation and your language ability isn't a barrier, or you can turn on a TV show in your target language and understand it and enjoy it as if it was your native language. So the two methods just can't get you there. It doesn't matter how long you try to apply them. And so that's kind of what it boils down to. Now, when you kind of break down these categories, if you conceptualize immersion as being like you're doing no study, you're just trying to learn the same way an infant does, I think that would work, but it's going to be pretty slow. And that's not actually what I did. I actually took a combination of what you might call the pure immersion and the Tim Ferriss method, where, you know, learning the most common 1,000 words and the most common grammar stuff, that's really beneficial. It's really important. That alone is not nearly enough. But if you take that and you combine it with immersion, that's what's most powerful, because those most common 1,000 words, 2,000 words, that at least gives you a starting point so you're not totally lost. And once you have that starting point, you can start figuring things out on your own and improve through the immersion.
Okay. And when I think about it in hindsight, like Tim Ferriss did, like specific to Japanese, at least he did go for that period of time over to Japan and essentially immerse himself in the culture. Like I think he had a semester or a whole year over in Japan.
I mean, yeah, that's an interesting point that you mentioned, is that there's a lot of people who, you know, they're like, for example, that middle method that you mentioned, the traditional method, where you just study the grammar and the vocab, that's probably the most popular method. That's what you do when you take a college class or something. And you can find a lot of people that are like, yep, that's how I learned French and I'm fluent in French. But if you actually sit down and talk to them, they lived in France for a semester and they lived their whole life in French. And when they first got there, they sucked, but they slowly got better. So there's people who basically, they got good at a language and they're misinterpreting what they did to get good. Like they did these 10 things and they're thinking that it was like the first two things they did that made them get good. Whereas in my opinion, it might be these other five things. And they're just, you know, they were told that taking classes is what's important. So they kind of have this confirmation bias and they just have been playing that out in their own experience. But for me, when I look at all the people who have gotten good at a language, the one common denominator is that they've actually contacted that language for hundreds and thousands of hours.
Mm. Yeah, correlation does not equal causation. Maybe in that case, it's just, again, another gateway to getting you over there to immerse yourself. Like when I think about it, my wife, her dad, half German, half Polish, but immigrated here. He wasn't born yet. So his mother was pregnant and they arrived here in Australia. Growing up, he's sort of immersed with the German language because his mother's around, but he did no formal, he didn't study German at school because it wasn't cool to learn German just after the war. And so, you know, he had a basic understanding, like key words, and they'd be watching it through TV and stuff like that. But then when he was 21, he went to Germany and he lived there for like 9 months. And so he picked it up completely. But what was really odd is he never told my wife when she was studying German at high school, like that he knew German. So she struggled with German, doing traditional style German, and he was fluent the whole time. We get to Germany when we're about 22 together and they joined us for a period of time. And he just starts like speaking full fluent German. And we're like, how the hell do you know German? He's like, oh, I learned it when I was here. It's so, yeah, this makes a lot more sense now in hindsight.
Yeah. And I mean, if you want to really talk about the mechanics of it, which is one of my, it's kind of nerdy, but it's one of my favorite topics. And I think it's also why I've been able to kind of play a role in making the immersion method more popular is because when you really talk about the logic behind it, it makes sense. And the way that I like to talk about it is based on a framework that was created by this linguist named Stephen Krashen a couple decades ago, actually, where he created this distinction between what he called learning a language and acquiring a language. And he said, these are two completely different processes or things we can do that both try to get us to the point of being able to have language ability. So learning is the traditional, you know, you're consciously studying grammar and vocabulary. And then when you're trying to speak, you're actually basically trying to use these grammar rules that you memorize and stuff in real time to kind of translate your thoughts into the language. Mm. And then acquisition is how we learned our first language. It's actually a subconscious process that happens through getting lots of input in the language. So, you know, in English, there's a lot of grammar rules that if I asked you to explain them, you couldn't explain them, but you're using them perfectly and effortlessly whenever you open your mouth to speak the language. So this kind of is the result of acquisition. You actually don't know it consciously at all, but part of you does know it intuitively. And when you hear someone mess it up, you know, oh, that's not right. You got to do it like this.
Yeah.
And so the idea in my kind of model is that we actually still have access to language acquisition, even as an adult. We don't lose that ability. Maybe we get a little rusty, not quite as fast at acquiring language as an infant, but it's still very much there. And in fact, it's the only way to reach fluency in a language.
It's really interesting you talking about that acquisition way of learning, because I just remember recently I read, have you ever read Steven Pinker's book? Language Instinct?
Yeah, I have actually. I'm a fan of that book.
Yeah, it's really interesting because he talks about how like language will change with children and the way that they acquire it.
Mm-hmm.
The example was given for like pigeon languages. So if initially it was a original language and then was distorted into something, i.e. pigeon, which is like a type of English, and then the next layer or generation would start to like pick up naturally the structure of a language and elevate it to a language rather than from a pigeon style language. It's really interesting how that whole works. I don't fully understand it. I can't remember it wrote from the book.
I think that's a good explanation. I think another example he gave in the book is how there was this child who was born deaf. His parents could hear, but he was born deaf. And so the parents tried to teach him sign language, and the parents themselves weren't totally fluent in sign language. So they would make grammatical mistakes and things like this. And the kid managed to learn like perfectly grammatical sign language from his parents who spoke broken sign language. Just kind of going to show this part of the brain that actually is born with an instinct for language.
That's right.
And was able to kind of fill in the blanks on its own. So yeah, just that, again, all these examples that he cites goes to show that our brain is built for language. That's why we're able to learn it through input, right? Normally you'd think how if I just listen to this thing that I largely don't understand, how am I going to learn anything, right? If I just listen to, you know, math lectures without paying attention, I'm not going to learn math. But the thing is, we didn't evolve specifically to consciously learn math. That's kind of the ability to learn math is a byproduct of other things that happened evolutionarily. But we did evolve to use language very specifically. And so there's a part of the brain that's really dedicated to that. I mean, another piece of evidence is that there's a specific part of the brain where if that portion of the brain is damaged during stroke, you just lose your language ability. And then you're fine in almost every other way. It's called asphasia, I think. I might be pronouncing
that wrong. That sounds right. I've heard of this. I feel like it was covered in the book as well.
Yeah,
it's interesting you mentioned about the kid, and like there was a group of kids in somewhere in Latin America which they learnt sign language, and it's no different in terms of how it's spoken, really, bar maybe the symbols that they use with their hands, or the signals rather. It's no different to other sign languages around the world, which I found really, really interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, that goes to your point about it being sort of, Dan, I guess this is an interesting point because you've spoken a bit in previous interviews about how you're sort of in this maintenance mode. You know, you've acquired the language, it's there in your brain, but you kind of can lose it, right? Because if you don't use your muscle memory, let's call it, in your brain, you can lose that sort of stuff. Do you think that that is a quick process, or do you think once the brain's acquired it, in your experience, like have you ever gone a period of time where you've just not spoken Japanese for a few months?
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
And it definitely gets worse. I mean, what I kind of find is that if my peak Japanese ability is 100 and I don't use Japanese for a while, it might fall down to like 80 or 70, but it never really goes below 70. I mean, I've gone periods pretty, you know, multiple months at a time of like almost not doing anything with Japanese, and it kind of falls to a 70, and then getting it back up to like 90 is really easy. You can go from like a 70 to back up to 90 in like maybe a couple of weeks of just listening to Japanese more, speaking Japanese more. And then if I want to go back from 90 to 100, then I might have to really focus on it for a month or two. That's what I found.
So you've done a video with, how do you pronounce his name in New York? Xiaoma. Yeah. So I, for years on YouTube, had followed Xiaoma.
Oh, cool.
Unfortunately, Lao Shu, who passed away recently, I think it was last year. There's no doubt that there's like this intrigue for people in linguistics around polyglots. Like there's something so unique about it that humans find fascinating. And let's say both polyglots and people who are unusually completely fluent. Like in your case, in your video, you've got a pitch accent in Japanese and you're in this store, so to speak, and you guys are speaking Japanese. What made you, when you look at those sort of guys, what consideration did you ever give to going down the polyglot sort of direction versus being an ultra specialist in a certain language? And I know that Refold has other languages, but I guess I'm just intrigued around that sort of specialization, or do you not see it that way?
I mean, that's a really good question. For me, when I first started learning Japanese, I was only interested in Japanese. And actually, until the point of starting to learn Japanese, I wasn't interested in languages at all. I had taken Spanish in middle school and for the first part of high school before I switched into Japanese, and I was not interested in it. So for the longest time, I couldn't imagine learning any language other than Japanese. Then after a couple of years of just doing Japanese, Chinese started to seem pretty interesting, and I kind of dabbled a little bit in Chinese. And then over time, I started to kind of come around to the appeal of like, oh yeah, every language is so unique. And, you know, it's kind of like through learning Japanese, I got this new window into a new universe. Imagine what the universe of French looks like, or the universe of Spanish looks like. So I did start to feel that temptation. But ultimately for me, the better that I got at Japanese, the more value that Japanese gave back to me. And it always felt like continuing to invest in Japanese was always the wisest thing that I could do. And especially because I always planned on Japanese being such a significant portion of my life. I always wanted my Japanese to be as good as possible, right? It's like, if I'm going to spend a couple hours or maybe a couple tens of hours every single week reading, listening, talking to people in Japanese, I want that to be the best possible experience. I never want my language ability to be even a little bit rusty, ideally, because otherwise then, you know, what would be the point of reading a book in Japanese if it's really hard for me when I could just pick up the English equivalent and it'd be easy? right? So I wanted them to both be easy. So for me, that's always my perspective. And then when I looked at the potential being a polyglot, what normally comes with that is, first of all, a lot of just time going into maintenance, right? For the people that try to maintain a lot of languages at a high level, their whole life revolves around it, right? They have to have a schedule of like, where they're keeping track of, okay, I got to spend 3 hours on French this week, 4 hours in German, and it's really intense. Or the alternative is you just let your languages that you're not focused on atrophy and get really, really rusty and really bad. And then you have to go back and revive them. And so you're constantly kind of, some things are getting worse, other things are getting better, and you're playing this juggling game. And all of those just sounded really stressful to me. And so I think that's totally valid if that's what you're into. Like for some people, that's just the most interesting thing for them. Like for them, getting to the intermediate level kind of scratches the itch that they have for a language. And then they're more interested in going on to a new language than continuing to pursue that one. But for me, I always kind of viewed something Katsumoto said is a language is not a hotel. It's a home that you move into. And that's always the way that Japanese has felt for me.
That's so funny because, look, the one thing I picked up from your personality just watching and learning about you is it's similar to mine in that, because I know you're a big fan of meditation. I meditate daily. I've noticed there's a commonality amongst people who come on the show who love meditation but are also like optimization freaks and geeks, mm-hmm. which I would put you in that bracket. You know, you've done some of those things where you've got like the time boxes and you'll put devices mm-hmm. or things within it. And I guess I was just curious, how useful is meditation to you to combating that A-type element of your personality?
I mean, for me, meditation has been indispensable because it kind of helps cope with ADHD. I think actually I got diagnosed with ADHD a couple months ago. I mean, I've always had it, but I had a couple friends who were actually older than me and they're very similar to me. And they got diagnosed with ADHD. Actually, one of them got diagnosed with ADHD. Then the other one followed in his footsteps, got diagnosed. So I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. Let me figure out if I really have it or not. And I went and actually got diagnosed. And apparently I do have it. And in some ways, it's a helpful framework to kind of understand my behavior. Another aspects, I don't want it to be like a limiting belief of like, oh, I have this deficiency, so therefore X. Like I try not to really think in that way.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think definitely I have tendencies of basically hyper-focus on the things that I'm really interested in and a really hard time focusing on the things that I'm not interested in. And because of this, I always really sucked at school. Was good for Japanese. I was interested in it, so I could stay really focused. But now being an adult, trying to run a business, sometimes you need to, both sides of that can hurt you, right? If you get too into, you know, something that you're passionate about, like for me, if sometimes I'll spend 2 days straight doing nothing but editing a video and I'll neglect my health and other things. And then there's other things that are just boring, but you need to do, and they're important. So for me, meditation has helped kind of curve that tendency and let me have more control and more discipline over what I'm doing with my attention.
Is ADHD a functional illness? I have irritable bowel syndrome. So what they describe as a functional illness is often sometimes related to actually symptoms of the nervous system, typically. Is ADHD that, or is it something that is actually happening within the brain?
I mean, I think one way that I've heard it described, and again, I'm definitely not too knowledgeable about this, but that people with ADHD have less dopamine in their brain.
And that's
one of the main causes, because, you know, when you have lower baseline levels of dopamine, then you're going to have a tendency to engage in dopamine seeking behavior. And that on one hand means like when you really get interested in something, you finally found something that gave you dopamine, you don't want to stop doing it. And so you hyperfocus. And then when something's like a task isn't very stimulating, then it just is so painful because, you know, you feel like understimulated.
Oh, wow. So it's almost like having like a dopamine addiction.
Yeah. And I mean, that's why when you look at the ADHD medication, like Adderall and Ritalin, like what they really do is just boost the dopamine level in your brain.
Wow.
So it kind of makes sense they're just stimulants, right? So
yeah,
that's the thing they say is that, and actually I'll say I actually tried the ADHD meds and decided that they weren't for me, but apparently they help a lot of people. But anyway,
it's a spectrum, right?
Yeah, it's a spectrum. I think it's also multidimensional. You know, there's different, some people have certain symptoms, not other symptoms. And it's really not a kind of a one one size fits all thing. But yeah, I mean, what they say is that when a normal person takes a stimulant like Adderall, they get really hyped up and energetic, and you know, they're all bouncing off the wall. Whereas someone who truly has ADHD, when they take Adderall, they actually get calmer rather than more energetic, because now that they finally have the normal dopamine level, they don't have the urge to go and be seeking, you know, stimulation so much. They actually get calmer.
Yeah.
That's what they say.
I definitely potentially have that. Like, there's definitely like an element of that. I wonder if there's like a relation to like a personality traits as well. And that sort of defines your personality in a way.
I think so. I mean, they say people like, you know, Elon Musk and Steve Jobs, they all have it too, right? So clearly it's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it's something that can be a strength, but you need to learn to work with it. You know,
it's a double-edged sword for sure.
Yeah.
What if I told you the way to take your brand to the next level in 2021 is with TikTok ads? A lot of our clients come to us with a problem. They need to take their brand to the next level. They're typically doing 5 to 10K a month, and they need to jump to that 25, 50K per month level. And Instagram and Facebook just isn't what it was. So what's the commonality amongst all this? It is primarily opportunity in a saturated market. And we think that TikTok ads today is the answer. Now, Narelle follows a two-phase process to guide you as a challenger brand on the way to growth. Phase one is all about knowing your brand and niche back to front with a focus on breaking even or getting above a break even. Phase two is scaling that creative to blow up your sales in the process once we've secured you as the leader in that niche on TikTok. You do this with the right partner, a committed partner like Narelle, and you'll build that confidence in an area that has typically been saturated in the past. There's not a silver bullet, and we'd love to chat to you. So book in a consultation with our specialist team. Just go to narelle.com/TikTok. That's NERALLE.com/TikTok. And we'll chat to you from there. Before we get into sort of the YouTube and business side of things, I'm intrigued just to learn a little more about the pitch accent. I think as someone who's intrigued in Japanese culture, like it's so, yes, I can speak a little bit Japanese, but it's so obvious that like I have an accent, right? When I go over there, like we have friends in regional Japan, they always have a chuckle at me pronouncing certain words with my Australian accent. Probably because I like to put it on a little bit more because they love it over there. They're like, kangaroo, kangaroo, yeah, you know, that type of stuff. But can you explain what a pitch accent is? And, you know, like the person who sort of dominated this space in terms of learning is Dogen. And yeah, I'm just intrigued to learn a little bit more about what it actually is and how you go about mastering it.
Yeah, so pitch accent is a phonetic feature of Japanese wherein the easiest way to say it is that every word is pronounced with a specific melody. And this melody is just as much a part of the pronunciation of a word as the vowels and the consonants.
Okay.
And so if you change this melody, you can actually completely change what word you're saying. So you can have the same vowels and consonants. For example, a common example is hashi, means chopsticks. And if you take that same series of vowels and consonants, but change the melody to hashi, then now that can mean bridge. And so it's completely different. Like the word in the dictionary is different, becomes a different word.
Yeah. Okay. So in a way, it's actually quite similar to Chinese, but less, is there less complications? Like I remember at high school, the principal was obsessed with Chinese because China is like our biggest trading partner in Australia. And he would talk about how the word ma had six different pitches and six different meanings. Is it as complicated as that with most Japanese words, or a little less so? Because the language is quite a structured language in comparison.
Yeah, yeah. So tones and pitch accent are really similar. The difference is actually just that tones play out on a syllable by syllable level, whereas pitch accent plays out on a per word level. So if you have a word in Chinese that has two syllables, there's going to be two different tones. The first syllable will have a tone, the second syllable will have a tone. In Japanese, every word has one pitch accent. And actually, I think that pitch accents overall more complicated than tones, because in a way, because tones play out on a per syllable basis and the whole language is made up of syllables, right? Basically, the different tones don't influence each other very much. Mm. Sometimes the previous one can have an influence on the following one, but it's very limited and predictable. Whereas in Japanese, the pitch accent, depending on how things conjugate, it will become very complicated depending how things, one thing attaches to another word can be changed, and then intonation can affect pitch accent in a certain way. So it ends up being really complicated, actually, when you look at it at the whole sentence level. On the per word level, it's not too hard.
Yeah, because if you look at like Chinese, if it's at a syllable level, you clearly know how what variation to change. Yes, there's more variations, but you know which one is changing, so it's easier to do.
Whereas yeah, and
the
actually,
whole word is... It's
there's not actually
harder.
More variations. In Mandarin Chinese, there's four tones. And in Japanese, in standard Japanese, there's four main pitch accent patterns.
Oh, wow.
So in Cantonese, there's more tones, but there's also other dialects of Japanese that have more pitch accent patterns as well. So I think it's kind of even game.
Right. So you started uploading instructional videos to YouTube, probably 2015. You built up this library. I think Jacob found your videos after he got like a bad test result in Japanese. He was like wondering how do I get better at this. Interestingly, he ended up going to study in Japan. I think he lived and worked there at the, I can't remember which university, somewhere in Kyushu in the south. He was there for at least a whole semester minimum, potentially a year. So obviously you had a good impact on him.
Cool.
What was the original motivation for you? Was it a selfish one? You just want to get better for yourself, and teaching people is the best way to do that in a way?
Yeah. So I had been making YouTube videos for a couple of years before I got serious about it, purely as a hobby. And I think the motivation there was just that I was really passionate about the specific way of learning Japanese that no one else was talking about at the time. Like back then, if you tried to Google for the specific techniques I was using, nothing would come up. Or on YouTube, I mean, when you searched on Google, AJAT would come up, but on YouTube, literally no one was talking about it. And so for me, because I didn't have anyone I could talk to about this method or anything like that, I ended up having to figure out a lot of stuff on my own. I made a lot of mistakes and I learned a lot of things, discovered new things, new techniques that worked really well for me. So I just naturally had a desire to share them because I was so passionate about them and I had no one to share them with. I didn't know anyone in real life learning Japanese. And so I would just make some videos just for fun, completely just out of the desire to share. And then at a certain point, I decided to leave college because it was just, I hated it so much and needed something else to do. And so I kind of thought, hey, what if I made a Patreon and did this more seriously? I wonder if I could really make this work. Because at that point I had, you know, a couple hundred viewers that I just kind of built up organically. And so, yeah, I guess it was kind of the combination of like, hey, I liked it, pretty passionate about it, and I needed to do something with my life. I didn't have any other really good ideas.
Yeah. And there's always a moment when you start doing this thing as well, where you get those signals that you're on the right direction, whether it's some sort of growth or outbreak in follower numbers or a certain piece of feedback. Like for me, it's often like a message that I get on Instagram after interviews. And we've created all sorts of new relationships and friends from doing this podcast, which has been quite amazing. I know you've had the opportunity to collaborate with Dogen, Atsuigo. There's a bunch of linguists as well. Like I think I noticed Steve Kaufman at one point. How crucial do you think that was for your growth? Or do you see other points in time before you start the initial business MIA? Do you look back and identify like a few points in particular that really stood out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the collaborations definitely had a really big impact. And it's really over the course of 2020 that my channel had a huge growth spurt. Like I think I only had like maybe 20 or 30,000 subscribers. Maybe around 20,000 subscribers. I could be remembering this wrong, but at the beginning of 2020, and then I was getting, you know, close to 100K by the end of the year. So I think a lot of factors came together. I had some collaborations with other big YouTubers that helped a lot. I had a couple of videos that went like semi-viral, at least, you know, they had a lot more views than the views that I had. And also, I think a lot more people started learning languages when the pandemic started because everyone was at home and didn't have anything else to do. I think that also gave my channel. And more people were just watching YouTube, I think. So I think a lot of factors kind of came together.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was. Like, so I was following Chris Broad and all those sort of J vloggers in Japan. We've interviewed a few when we went over there in sort of, when was it, 2018, which was a lot of fun. And so I feel like that was how I found you, is like there was a recommendation and, you know, you may have done something with Dogen and that's how I found it. I don't know what year that was, but anyway, it's quite intriguing as to how the algorithm works. Let's talk about business though. So the first foray into business was with Lucas. You had this mass immersion approach. I think you spoke about this, both of you had a falling out and you went your own separate ways, doing your own different projects. That's sort of pretty standard these days when you run a business. We've all had that at some point. When you look back at that period, was there any particular lessons or principles you took away from that that project that you guys built together?
I mean, yes, so many things. Like I knew literally nothing going in. And because we did have a pretty nasty falling out and unfortunately a kind of public one, I try to, you know, not really talk too much about the details. Obviously, I'm very biased, right? So it's kind of hard for me to tell my side of the story without speaking really negatively about Lucas. And I'm sure the same goes for him on his end. So I try to just, you know, keep it private. But yeah, I mean, so many things. I think probably the biggest thing is we didn't have a really good division of labor. We were both trying to kind of do everything.
Yeah.
Like we would, there was kind of two pieces to what you were doing. We would create content, we would create software. And I think Lucas was too involved. And so I was mainly the content guy. He was mainly a software guy, but I think I was too involved with the software and he was too involved with the content. And so we were wasting a ton of time and always bickering about stuff because we wouldn't really just kind of like trust the other person to do their, you know, part of the labor.
Okay. Yeah. And that, you know, like every time I interview founders, every time a business has failed because the founders split up or whatever it may be, because it is like it's like a marriage, you know, I literally, my business is with my wife as co-founders. So you've got to find a balance. And yeah, I think one of the things for us that works is the fact that everything creative she handles, and everything strategy and business I handle, and I could not do what she does and she could not do what I do. And every time we interview people and we speak to them, that is a common thing. So,
yeah, I mean, I think you got to know who has the final word on what part, and you got to be willing to step back when it's the other person's final word.
And yeah. And particularly if that person is more passionate about the decision around that, sometimes it just makes it easier and just be like, okay, fine, you just handle it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
So Refold essentially founded last December with your co-founder, Ethan. He's a software engineer. He's moved to South America to learn Spanish. The goal of Refold is stated as demolish the language barrier. And it seems, of course, we know to be an immersion-based system. How does the program work and why is it more advantageous than other systems?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little biased, but I think it's the best way to learn a language. And that's why I basically took all my experience and all my research on the best ways to learn a language and put it into a structured system so that other people could replicate it. And that's exactly what it is. And so the way that it works is we break the whole language learning process into four stages. The first stage is kind of what you described earlier on as the Tim Ferriss type stuff. You're learning the most common 1,000 to 2,000 words. You're getting a very basic introduction to the grammar and just kind of laying that groundwork so that when you jump into the language, you're not totally lost. Then in stage two, you start immersing yourself in the language and consuming as much content as you can in that language. And you're trying to really focus on building up your comprehension. And that's mostly done through mass exposure, but you also systematically make flashcards out of the words and phrases that are coming up in your immersion.
Right.
And you use what's called a spaced repetition system, which is basically a program that has an algorithm that calculates the optimal time for you to study all your flashcards. So you do this to grow your comprehension as quickly as possible. Wow. And then in stage three, you work on speaking. So this is probably one of the most unorthodox aspects of the approach. But at the beginning, you're not focused on speaking at all. You're focused entirely on listening and reading comprehension. And then in stage three, you start actually speaking. But what happens is, since you've had so much exposure to the language and you've kind of built up an instinct for the language through getting so much input in it, you start being able to speak really naturally. And you know, you still make mistakes. It's still difficult at first, but it's going to come to you much more quickly. And you're going to end up getting much better, much more quickly than people who try to speak at the very beginning. So by the end of stage three, you have basic fluency in the language. And then stage four is taking that basic fluency and increasing it to basically go as far as you want. You know, there's kind of no end point. You can take it all the way up to, you know, native level fluency. Maybe you go past native level fluency, you try to become the next Mark Twain of your target language. It's totally up to you. It's kind of like, you know, you get off the ride whenever you've had enough.
Really interesting you mentioned before about that algorithm. I look, for me, the biggest thing is like, how does a business like this go from being, because, you know, you've said in previous interviews, your current goal is to get people like Jacob who not so much have fallen off the bandwagon, but are passionate language learners and have had struggles over the time. And then you draw them in through this system, let's call it. So to me, actually, the go-to-market is not about marketing or talking about it so much on your YouTube channel. It's about developing the product. And so I'm intrigued, where does the development go from here? I.e., is it horizontally with more language, or is it vertically with the way that you teach people? How do you guys view that at the moment?
Well, the first thing that we're focusing on right now is building products that help people implement this process. So one of the first things we did is we built a Japanese flashcard deck for this system that's completely optimized to this method. The thing is, there's a lot of textbooks out there. There's a lot of even Anki decks and other things out there that are meant to teach you Japanese or another language. But they're not optimized for the immersion method. They're optimized for the traditional method that doesn't actually work very well. So we're going to work on creating guides, or basically flashcard decks and grammar guides that are optimized specifically for this process. And we are going to do that in many languages. You know, we have to do that through partnering with other people who are experts in each language, right? I can't write a French guide. I can only write a Japanese guide. So that's kind of the most basic thing. And then we're thinking of also actually selling the more advanced content itself. So there'll be kind of like a quick start guide for every language that's free. And there'll also be a language generic guide that goes in depth, but it's not customized or specific to any language that's free. And so if you don't want to spend any money, we want to make sure that you can take all the content we have and you can use that, and that'll be enough to get fluent. But if you want to save some time and some convenience, then there's going to be an in-depth guide customized and specific to each specific target language that will probably be behind a paywall as well. So those are kind of like the initial products on our roadmap.
That's really cool, because you can sort of see how if you recognize that you're not the specialist in the language, you can bring in other specialists, who exist on YouTube. And that in and of itself is a way of going to market and drawing in further people.
That's really, and it's kind of cool, because I've been doing YouTube long enough now that there's people who started learning a language by watching my videos and taking my advice, you know, 3-4 years back, and now are fluent in their target language. And so they've used this style of method and the style of approach, and a lot of them learned a language other than Japanese.
Mm.
So now we can kind of partner with those people and kind of bring them on board.
Go for the other one. Okay, so before we get into some rapid fire questions, I've got a self-interested question from Jacob, our producer. Now, he's in a bit of a pickle on that, you know, he's followed your content for a while. He was very consistent about input, and I think he was saying he was using the SRS daily, but he's hit a bit of a wall, and that could be me burning him out with work as well. So, you know, he's struggling with time, so to speak. I'm sure this is something you've been asked plenty of times, but what advice do you give to people who experience language burnout? You've experienced it yourself being in Japan. How can someone take a step back? Is it as simple as maybe introducing things generally in their life that make them take a step back, like meditation, exercise, eating better, stuff like that? Or is there something else in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on what the cause of the burnout is. You know, you mentioned that Jacob is using the SRS a lot, Anki, this flashcard program. Yeah. A lot of people, that's the cause of burnout for them. Because the way this flashcard program works is that it tells you when you should study what cards to the day. So every day it's going to tell you, study these 30 cards or these 70 cards today. And if you don't study those, and then you're going to have a new 70 to study tomorrow. So if you skip today, you have 140 tomorrow. And then you have even more the next day. So they pile up really, really quickly. And this can be a constant source of stress, because it's like, oh, I have to review every single day. I can't take a day off. And so a lot of times that's the source of stress. So if that's the case, then I would say stop learning new cards in the program and only review your old cards. Because if you do that, the number of reviews will go down really low. It's the new cards that you have to review a lot. And the other thing is, there's basically this feature inside of the program where if you fail the same content over and over, it will kind of say like, okay, this isn't sticking. It'll remove it from the deck. It's called when a card becomes a leech. So okay. A lot of people, they actually turn this feature off because they have this kind of completist mindset of like, I want to know 100% of the content. I don't want to, you know, if it's not sticking, I'll study it extra. But what happens is you can end up spending, you know, 80% of your time on the, you know, not even 20, sometimes the 2% of content that's not sticking that much. Yeah. And that's just really inefficient. So make sure you're using the leech feature to take out all the cards that aren't sticking. And if you do these two things, your reviews will go down really low. And then maybe just don't learn any new cards for a while. Instead, go try to find some new content in the language, find a new TV show that you like, and be more kind of relaxed about it for a little bit, or go back to whatever inspired you to learn the language. Try to kind of, you know, remind yourself about the passion that you have for it.
So almost like when you're growing, just maybe if it's plateauing out, recognize that you need a maintenance mode period. You need to give yourself a break.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think it's really important to be able to coast in the language because that's like for me, I can, in a way, there's diminishing returns. So the better you get, the harder it is to improve further. So for me in Japanese, I'm at a level where, you know, I could consume content in Japanese for 3 hours a day. And that's just maintaining. I'm not actually really gaining anything beneficial. I'd have to live my like 10 hours a day to get my Japanese at a higher level. Because the thing that's holding me back is actually using English. When I use English, I get used to using English style thought patterns. And then when I speak Japanese, I have these English style thoughts coming up. Whereas when I speak Japanese all day, I start having more Japanese style thoughts. And then my English gets bad. Yeah. So there's that issue. But I mean, if you're not fluent yet, 3 hours a day of just watching TV shows will make you improve a lot. So for most people, they can be pretty relaxed about it and actually still get the benefits of it. And so that's why the ability to coast and not always be, you know, pushing the acceleration pedal is really important. Because, you know, you're going to have, you know, ebbs and flows with your energy levels and your motivation. So it's really important that when you're going through one of those kind of, you know, slumps with your motivation, instead of doing nothing, you're kind of in chill mode, which is still really beneficial for learning language.
There you go, Jacob. You heard it here first. That's what you got to do, my man. You got to chill out a bit. All right. Rapid fire questions to finish things off. Tell me, on a day like today, what is your morning routine and what will you do as your evening routine after this?
Yeah, well, so we already kind of talked about meditation, but what I try to do is get up, take a shower, meditate, and then I do my own Anki cards that I do.
Okay.
So.
And evening, how do you sort of decompress at night?
Yeah, well, I mean, I like to watch TV shows in Japanese. It's one of my favorite things to do. But then, recently I've been trying to up my sleep hygiene. So I've been trying to turn off all the screens an hour before bed and read a paper book. And actually, I saw on the other rapid fire questions, one of them was a purchase. Is it okay if I go to that one?
Yeah, it kind of ties in. Yeah, what have you, what's the best purchase under $200?
Yeah, so this is something that I just got recently. They're basically just smart light bulbs. So I got 4 smart light bulbs in my room, which are basically just light bulbs that you can program to be, you know, any color you want, any shade you want, and you can turn them on and off at certain times. And so I did a couple of things with this. It actually ties in the morning and evening routine. I have them so that they start slowly fading on 30 minutes before I want to wake up. And I found like this has made a huge difference. It's never been so easy to wake up on time because, you know, my brain thinks the sun has been out for a half hour by the time my alarm goes off. And I find myself waking up naturally. And then I also have it set so that in the morning, the light bulbs are on like maximal blue light mode. And then in the evening, they're in the like really orangey, no blue light mode. Yeah. So I have them, you know, naturally, I have different, they're called scenes, you know, where you have what lights are onto what brightness level. So that, you know, at 8 o'clock, they start coming down. And then at 10 o'clock, they go really dark. And that's the kind of signal, okay, put my phone off and then I can go read. And I found that's made having a good sleep schedule be a lot smoother.
They're not LifeX bulbs, are they?
The ones that I got, they're called, I think they're like Sen LED or something.
Okay.
When you look them up, the most popular brand is called Philips Hue.
Yeah.
But they're Philips ridiculously Hue. Expensive. So I basically, on Amazon, there was just like an off brand that was like a third of the price and it has been working just as well for me. So
yeah, the big brand here in Australia is LifeX. I've got 3 of them. Our downlight for the studio is a LifeX bulb because it's like you can do 1,000 colors or something like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've got the same thing. Every time I wake up in the morning, it starts to come on. And then when my Apple Watch alarm goes off, which is a bit more natural than that blaring alarm, I'm just a bit better rested. Made a massive difference. the thing I need to get fixed is nighttime. I need a better like time because I'll have my phone will go into sleep mode at like 9 and I read for an hour every night. But I think I need to use those LifeX lights as a better signal for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, one other thing that that I've been doing that kind of has been interesting. This was actually under like an ADHD kind of life hack, but they said you should set an alarm at every hour of the day just to kind of keep you aware of how much time is passing. And I did that with the lights. So once an hour, the lights like for 5 seconds, turn a completely different color and then turn back. Wow. And then I set it so that the light, what color it flashes changes throughout the day so that I can like intuitively know like, oh, it's 3 o'clock. And I've found that that has been doing a pretty good job of making me aware of like how much time I'm doing. So if I'm ever like, you know, getting lost and surfing the web, it's kind of like, okay, let's get back on task.
I like it. That's really cool. I need to integrate that. Matt, thank you so much for coming on. I know it's getting to probably past dinner time or getting near dinner time in the US. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
Yeah, well, so my YouTube channel is Matt vs. Japan. I'm on Twitter as well, Matt vs. Japan. And the website we've been talking about is refold.la. You can think of it as for language.
Okay. We'll link all of that as well. I encourage anyone who's looking at learning languages. Here in Australia, we're all really excited to travel overseas. I know a lot of people will be wanting to go to the UK and the US, but for anyone going to Europe and particularly Japan, you should check out Refold. Matt, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you liked it, do subscribe. And of course, like it on YouTube if you're watching as well. We'd really appreciate that. For audio, if you've not already listening on your podcast app, you can search for it on any good app, including Spotify, Pocket Cast, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, etc. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube. It's the first one that appears every single time. But behind the scenes, do follow us on Instagram and TikTok. It's @uncommon_show. But until next time, thanks for tuning in.